What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world, not forgetting current events that occur, plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah, Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
And we welcome you in to Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus, the last show of July. It's the 28th. Rich Lenkoff, Jason Whiteside in studio here at Tribune Tower. My name is Sam Panionovic, and plenty of topics to get to per usual. We have the resignation of Roger Ailes for his sexual harassment in the workplace. We've got a recent ruling for U.S. District Judge William Alsup, the legal grab bag, and more. But we're going to start on the phone lines with Attorney Leonard Goodman, who represents Governor Rod Blagojevich, who is appear at resentencing via closed circuit TV. There was a status hearing yesterday. Goodman is a criminal defense attorney here in Chicago, and he joins us now on WGN. Good morning, Leonard.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, welcome back to Legal Face-Off. We appreciate having you. So just by way of background, really quickly, I'm sure all of our listeners know the Blagojevich story, but very briefly, he was convicted in 2011 of misusing his powers as governor. He is currently serving a 14-year prison sentence in Colorado, of which he has now served roughly 4 years. Last year, federal appeals court dismissed 5 counts against him, still left him convicted on 13 counts. They ordered a resentencing hearing, but they called the evidence against Blagojevich overwhelming and made it clear that Judge Zagel, the sentencing judge, the trial judge, that his sentence was not out of bounds. And in March, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear Blagojevich's appeal. So as Sam mentioned, on August 9th, there'll be a hearing before Judge Zagel on the resentencing. And Leonard, you are the chief lawyer for Blagojevich in that hearing, correct?
Correct.
So there was a status hearing yesterday. What was the demeanor of your opponent like? I know they came out very forcefully in the media saying they have come out and saying, and in their brief they said that they, you know, vehemently disagree with reducing his sentence. What's their position at this point?
Well, I mean, yesterday's hearing was just about logistics, how the governor will appear. And as you correctly said, he's going to appear by video conference. I mean, in terms of the government's position, you know, I find it a little disappointing. But I'm hopeful that between now and August 9th that they will soften their position a little bit, because it's, you know, they just simply don't want to acknowledge the fact that the centerpiece of their case has been determined to not have been a crime. Back in 2011, when he was originally sentenced, the case was about him trying to sell his office for personal gain. All of that is now gone. The appellate court said that wasn't a crime. That was political activity. So what's left of his case is violating the rules for raising political campaign funds. Blagojevich is probably the only person in modern history, the only elected official that has been prosecuted and incarcerated for violating the rules for raising campaign funds. You know, most political corruption cases, in fact, all political corruption cases other than Blagojevich, involve people who take gifts and loans, Ferraris, Rolex watches, cash bribes, free vacations, or people that take money out of their campaign.
Including, by the way, the current nominee for vice president of the United States on the Democrat Party. Now, in Virginia, that what Tim Kaine took was legal, but, you know, actually took things that, you know, Governor Blagojevich never even come close to taking, right?
That's correct. You know, it's puzzling why it's so important to make an example out of Blagojevich still after after the main part of his case has been overturned. So,
Len, do you expect that Governor Blagojevich will testify or at least speak at the hearing? And if so, what do you think that he'll want to say to the court?
I'm sure he will. I think what he's going to focus on is, you know, what he's learned and over the last 4.5 years. I mean, I don't think Judge Zagel wants to hear a rehash of issues that he considered in 2011. I think he wants to hear, you know, what's new, what's changed about the governor, what he's been doing over the last 4.5 years, what he's learned. And, you know, as the press has reported, we've submitted more than 100 letters from fellow inmates, which is pretty remarkable. I've never had a client that inspired that kind of devotion from his fellow inmates. You know, and what they report, and you can read about it, it's the letters are all on the docket. You know, what they report is that Governor Blagojevich, you know, his generosity and his optimism has really inspired them, people to be better citizens, people to be better husbands and have better relationship with their own children. And seeing Blagojevich's example of the way his devotion to his own family, he's been teaching classes. He also teaches inmates before they're going to get out to how to interview for a job. You know, some of these people have never had a job before, and, you know, and they're incredibly grateful to what he's done. You know, he's not in there trying to hustle people or to try to, you know, try to help himself. He's really been very generous. And, you know, I think the judge will take all of that into account.
Talking to Leonard Goodman, Rod Blagojevich's appellate lawyer on Legal Face-Off on WGN+. Len, you talked about having him appear, you know, via, you know, on TV rather than in person. I read the government's position about, actually, the Bureau of Prisons, talking about the fact that it would take 2 weeks to get him up here from Colorado. They'd have to stop and, you know, basically, you know, involve what they call a con air. I mean, would you have preferred? I assume you would have preferred to have him there in person. Would he have been a little bit more impactful to have him there in prison versus through video?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it would have been better to have him here. It's just, you know, it's just the logistics of it. It's travel 2 ways there and 2 ways, 2 weeks here and two weeks back. It's disruptive. So I think this option, you know, maybe will serve the purposes for the hearing and be a lot less disruptive.
You know, and there was some discussion that Blagojevich himself had said that he would arrange his own private travel to get up here, but the prison system declined that. Is that unusual for an inmate to arrange their own private travel, and is that allowed ever?
Well, I think because he started in a regular prison. He's now been moved to a camp. He has an exemplary record. He's in a minimum security camp. You know, when his family comes to visit, he can walk out to the car and say goodbye. So, you know, under that circumstance, the fact that he would be given a short furlough to travel himself is not that unusual. You know, but it was denied, and so he's going to appear by video conference.
Leonard, he hasn't made a public appearance since March of 2012. People wondering, what does he look like? When was the last time you saw Blagojevich?
A couple years ago.
And physically, everything pretty much the same? How can we expect him to look when he's on closed-circuit TV?
I think, you know, I'm probably not the right person to ask, but I know he's in great shape. He works out, and, you know, he's grown in certain ways in prison. So I would think his appearance will be perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, I think I've told this story on the air before, but I actually visited him in prison in Colorado a couple of years ago because one of my associates was one of his trial lawyers. So we went to visit him, and at the time he was only, you know, a year and a half in maybe, but incredibly good spirits, you know, in good shape, really optimistic, you know, the same sort of Blagojevich that we've seen on TV. So I expect him to be the same. One last question, and we'll get you out of here. How do you think the acquittal of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell will affect Judge Zagel, if any? I know the issue in this case was different, but, I mean, if you're Judge Zagel, you got to be influenced by the fact that the Supreme Court just recently basically said that McDonnell, who, as you pointed out, or as you referenced, like, literally took Rolex watches and, you know, trips and suits, and he was acquitted, and the Supreme Court said that that wasn't, you know, a crime. How do you then sentence or keep Blagojevich in jail for another, you know, 8+ years?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and I think the judge will, you know, certainly will look at that case and look at other cases because, you know, I think really the problem for the government is there is no other case that you can point to of somebody that's in jail for what Blagojevich did.
which is essentially, you know, people that had state contracts, he hit them up for campaign funds. You know, and it's almost, you know, you look at the presidential race and you have, you know, one nominee that's going to raise $1 billion from corporate interests that all are expecting something in return. And that's apparently perfectly legal. So it's just hard. It's hard to understand why Blagojevich needs to spend another 10 years away from his family.
Leonard Goodman represents Governor Rob Blagojevich, a criminal defense attorney here in Chicago. The website, LenGoodmanLawOffice.com. The closed circuit TV resentencing hearing will take place on August 9th. Good luck. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Be sure to listen to Legal Face-Off on iTunes. Search for Legal Face-Off. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Search for Legal Face-Off and always rate, review, and share with a friend. Segment two, we go to Ohio and bring in Professor of Law at University of Dayton, Thaddeus Hoffmeister, who is a professor of criminal law and social media law, and he's here to talk about the effect of social media in court and also the recent ruling from U.S. District Judge William Alsup. Welcome to Chicago, Professor.
Well, thank you, Rich, and thank you, Jason, for having me.
Professor, thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off. Really interesting case that came down recently dealing with researching jurors online. By way of background, the ABA, the American Bar Association, has said that these searches are ethical. There was a ruling by the Missouri Supreme Court that said that not only can you do that, but that it suggested that attorneys actually have a duty to do it. Some other judges have called the online searches of jurors invasive and have banned them. Now it seems like we have a more definitive ruling from Judge Alsup in the Oracle Google case. Could you tell us first what the judge said in that case?
Okay. Well, specifically here, the judge, Judge Alsup, was concerned about maintaining juror privacy. He was under the belief that the parties would actually conduct online research of the jurors. And so what Judge Alsup directed was that if the parties were going to indeed research the jurors online, that they would have to make jurors aware of that fact. And as you might imagine, the attorneys were concerned they might offend some jurors, so they decided not to conduct online research.
Thaddeus, this is Jason here. You know, I think this is absolutely crazy, this ruling by the judge, because I know in trying cases, you know, jurors will tell you things. I mean, we use a juror consultant on the last trial, and you know, he was finding stuff on Facebook. The jurors will tell you things that, I mean, they don't want to, you know, announce it in front of a group of people. And they might say, yeah, I'll rule, you know, impartially. But then you get their Facebook profile. I mean, they have very, very partial views. And there's no way in the world they're going to be impartial. So I don't know how this is, the ruling's consistent with, as we point out, you know, the ABA guidelines and that. Where do you see this case going from there with that specific ruling?
Well, first, let me say I'm hesitant to call anybody who has a job for life crazy, but I do agree with you. I think this opinion goes against what most courts are doing, and I think it may have more to do with the judge's experience and familiarity with the Internet. I think as younger folks maybe sort of go up and become judges, they'll feel a little bit more comfortable. But I would say the majority of the judges that I interact with and that I follow allow folks to conduct research and don't place limitations. And I think that's the future. As was mentioned in Missouri, in civil cases, if you fail to research jurors on their state system, you may be prevented from raising juror misconduct claims after the fact. And as and I'll also mention what you said, you find out so much information about these jurors, and I think that's a good thing. I think the more information that attorneys have about jurors, it improves the system in a variety of different ways.
Just procedurally, walk us through how this will work. I'm coming off a jury trial. I had a 4-day jury trial last week, and we did not have the time to research anyone online. I've never done that before. You know, I think I'm always a little, you know, scared, a little sketchy about doing that. In this case, in this jury trial I had, which was a, you know, slip and fall premises liability case, what happens is we get, you know, we start the voir dire with the impanel of the jury. And we get a questionnaire, you know, a little postcard filled out by the jurors, and that has very basic information. And then, you know, right away we have to, you know, conduct our voir dire, and then we pick the panel. So where in that process would I, for example, do some online research of these prospective jurors?
Well, first of all, I would say it depends how deep the pockets are and how high profile the case is. One of the challenges, depending on your jurisdiction, I know in the federal court, sometimes they wait to the very last minute to give you the names. You get the names the day of. It varies by jurisdiction. Here in Ohio, we get them a little sooner. But so, again, I go back to how deep your pockets are, because some people outsource this and they use a consultant. And there are numerous consultants who have packages they will give you. They will do initial research, and they will also monitor the jurors throughout the trial. What other people do, they do it on their own. They do it in-house. They delegate it to a legal intern or to whoever's second chairing the trial. And again, it goes back to your particular jurisdiction and when you get the names. But I see it. I've seen it done. The example I'll give you is the dirty bomber Jose Padilla down in Federal District Court of Miami. They were doing it in the courthouse as they were calling the names out.
Professor, what do you think? How do you think that this will affect jury selection in the future? I mean, do you think that it, like you mentioned in Missouri, for example, will that be the standard nationwide? That, you know, you're almost committing, I won't say malpractice, but you're not maybe meeting your duty to your client if you're not conducting online research. Is that the trend as we see, you know, this type of research, you know, explode in the future?
Yeah, I definitely think it's a trend, and I think Judge Alsup will be in the minority. If you look at other parts of society, we work at a major university. We conduct Google's research on people who want to apply to school. Landlords do it. Employers obviously do it. Everyone is doing this. It's sort of the de facto rule. When someone's coming and you haven't met that person, you Google them. That's what people do. And it's only going to become more common. So I think, in fact, the jurors themselves are doing it, and they shouldn't be, but they do it anyways. So I think it's going to become more and more common, and I think the courts are going to want attorneys to do this because it serves a variety of purposes. One, it prevents this sort of wait to the end of trial to see if you can dig up something on jurors, because if you have them do it beforehand, that limits the possibility or the probability that attorneys are going to come after the fact and say, oh, look at this stuff we found, and had we known this, you know, we would have struck this juror, so we want to appeal this case or we want to miss trial. So that's definitely a benefit. But another benefit I like about it, and I think it's why it becomes more popular, is that with the more information attorneys have, the less likely then are they going to exercise peremptories based on their gut. All right, because unfortunately, a lot of times peremptories are based on physical characteristics. So they're going to base peremptories on your race. They're going to base on your gender. But if you give attorneys more information, they can make an educated peremptory based on knowledge. And I think as we're in this information age, you're not going to put the genie back in the bottle. So people are going to want this information. They're going to expect this information. So I don't think. Again, I think Judge Alsup is the minority. I think you're going to see more and more jurisdictions allow attorneys to do this without telling jurors that they're doing this. And I think most jurors at this point know that it happens because it happens in other aspects of their life. So I don't think it's a big surprise to them.
He is Professor Thaddeus Hoffmeister. He's a professor of law, University of Dayton, criminal law, social media law. Thank you for your time here on WGN+.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
And we welcome you back, Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus with Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. Back to the phones we go. We bring in Maya Ragu, who's the Director of Workplace Equality at NWLC, which is the National Women's Law Center. NWLC.com. She's here to talk about the resignation of Roger Ailes, sexual harassment in the workplace, and some other issues involving domestic violence. Good afternoon, Maya.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So you deal with workplace equality every day, and we're talking about Roger Ailes, who, as most people who are listening probably know, was basically forced out. He resigned from Fox News. He was the CEO, basically started the company many years ago, one of the most powerful media figures around, and he resigned 2 weeks after Gretchen Carlson, who was one of the stars on Fox News, alleged that he was, over the course of many years, sexually harassing her. And I think really the, maybe the final straw was when Megyn Kelly, who's also one of the most prominent talent on Fox News, also allegedly, she hasn't come out and said this, but allegedly told investigators that she was also the victim of sexual harassment. So my question to you, with that long-winded opening, is, on the one hand, you could say that this sends a positive message because, only 2 weeks after Gretchen Carlson's allegations came out, Roger Ailes, a very powerful figure, had to resign. On the other hand, I would submit that this doesn't really get us to where we want to be as a society because he left with, I think, a $60 million resignation package. And, this apparently was going on not just, with Gretchen Carlson, but with many women over the course of many years. So is it a mixed message? Is it positive, negative? What do you think?
Well, I think you've hit upon the interesting parts of this situation exactly, because what you have here is not only a very high-profile person who's been accused of sexual harassment, but usually in this situation, the person who is making the accusations is also a very high-profile person and a well-known media personality. And that has certainly brought a lot more attention and resources, and I would say even a certain amount of power to Gretchen Carlson's position in this situation. Because generally speaking, sexual harassment is always based on some sort of power differential. So that's why so many people are afraid to come forward and report harassment, and that's why frequently you may not see the person being accused of harassment, especially someone who may be very high up in a company, being held accountable for what happened based on the allegations. So that's what's so particularly interesting here is because, as you said, there was a very quick movement once she filed her lawsuit and her allegations were made public. Within 2 weeks, this very powerful figure resigned from the company. So that does send an important signal to people within the company and to society generally that, yes, even very powerful people can be held accountable, at least to some degree, when it comes to allegations of sexual harassment. Now, as you've also pointed out, he resigned and he apparently left with a contract with a nice payment in it. That's sort of the other side of the coin, is what does accountability look like and what does an employer do and what is it willing to do to address allegations and not only remedy what may have happened, but take steps to prevent it from happening again?
Maya, initially when the report came out from Gretchen Carlson and there was some talk, I thought it kind of sent a bad signal. I read a report that Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, they came out in massive support of Roger Ailes, said, they hadn't seen anything during his tenure. It was before he was terminated or resigned. And did you read that or did you see that at all?
I saw some reports about that, yes.
Yeah, well, including a lot of the female talent on there. I mean, not Gretchen mm-hmm. Carlson, but Kimberly Guilfoyle, who's a very prominent member of Fox News. She's an attorney. She came out very strongly in support of Roger Ailes. So, I mean, what?
Yeah, I guess I was just asking, I mean, why would they do that? Why would they? It's like they're going against their own, you know, an anchor woman.
Because look who their boss is, right? I mean,
but he's not anymore. I mean, I guess you don't know that and have that hindsight, but.
But I mean, is that common for, you know, coworkers to side with management for fear of retribution, you know, much like, you know, maybe Bill O'Reilly did coming out so strongly in favor of Roger Ailes?
Well, you've exactly hit upon the key point here, which is the fear of retribution. It's, again, a power differential. So you have the supervisor being accused of sexual harassment, and then you have people who are still in their jobs, and the person who was their coworker has now left their job. So Gretchen Carlson may have felt some freedom and may have felt less constrained to speak up about what had been going on for a long time, according to her. But the others are still in their jobs, and, you know, they could still face retribution, even though retaliation can be illegal. If they spoke out in her favor and supported her, so they are trying to protect themselves, which, you know, is reasonable in that situation, and it's not at all uncommon. That's why so few victims come forward to actually talk about what happened, because they're afraid of what's going to happen to them when they finally speak up. What are their coworkers going to say? Are they going to believe them? Or are they going to call them liars? Are they going to lose their job? Are their future professional prospects going to be harmed by speaking up in this situation? And I'm sure that's what her coworkers are worried about, too.
So, yeah, Ailes, I said $60 million. He left with a $40 million parachute settlement. Do you think that Gretchen Carlson didn't name anyone but Roger Ailes personally. She didn't name Fox News as a defendant, which, you know, often is the case just given the available resources of a Fox News versus a Roger Ailes. Do you think we'll see additional lawsuits now that, you know, this has come out? Do you think we'll see additional lawsuits and maybe naming Fox News and maybe even 20th Century Fox as the parent company as, you know, additional allegations are revealed and maybe more women come to the forefront?
That's certainly a possibility. From what I understand, they are conducting or have finished conducting an internal investigation. So it's entirely possible, depending on the results of that, that others within Fox might come forward, and maybe people within related companies that they own, too. It's an interesting time for them because they are taking positive steps to address the issue, but at the same time, indications based on the allegations seem to be that this kind of thing has been happening for a long time as well. So you don't know how long this has been going on, how many men or women this has been happening to. So it certainly could bring forward a lot of people who may see him having to resign as some sort of accountability on his part.
All right, we'll let you go with this last question. We talked about, message. I mean, message sending is very important in this area because it not only matters what happens in this particular case, but I think the message it sends to society as a whole. So Fox News, in essence, made a tacit concession that Roger Ailes did do these things. On the other hand, they didn't come out and say that. I mean, again, they paid him this $40 million settlement. Would you have preferred, do you think that, you know, justice would have been served and a proper message would have been sent if Fox News came out and said, yes, our investigation reveals that he was guilty of some misconduct and we took appropriate steps, rather than just, you know, giving this statement that they gave and letting him, you know, go off into the sunset with his big payday? Do you wish that the message was a little clearer from Fox?
It's always helpful when companies, especially large, powerful ones, take a clear stand on issues like this, because, as you pointed out, it sends a clear message not just to people within the company, but to sort of society generally that they don't condone this behavior and they take it seriously and they're taking steps to address it. So it's always better when that's the case. Certainly, I'm sure there are circumstances that led to them making the statement that they did.
Maya Ragu is the Director of Workplace Equality at the National Women's Law Center, NWLC.org. Thank you so much for your time here in Chicago.
Great. Thanks so much.
Be sure to listen to Legal Faceoff on iTunes. Find us on Facebook at Legal Faceoff, Twitter at The Legal Faceoff. Rate, review, and share with a friend. Legal Faceoff, the end of the show. As we always do it, we're going to close out with a legal grab bag. We've got seven topics today. We'll get right into it. Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside wrapping up another episode of Legal Faceoff. John Hinckley Jr. is set to be released, and he is the man who tried to shoot President Reagan, actually did shoot President Reagan, and out of prison.
Yeah, he tried and was successful.
I guess that's successful. Didn't assassinate him successfully, but still shot him. Either way, getting out of prison.
Yeah, released from prison finally after 35 years in jail for shooting the president. Actually killed Jim Brady. It was later. Jim Brady took a bullet in the brain and died around 3 or 4 years ago. The examiner ruled it a homicide. So John Hinckley officially is a murderer, but very famously at his trial.
He spent like 30 years in the mental institution.
Well, yeah,
right?
he was one of the most prominent people ever to claim the insanity defense and actually prevail on it. After his trial, but 3 years later, federally and many states changed the laws to make it much more difficult to even assert the insanity defense, let alone win it. But a lot of controversy over Hinckley being released. He's been actually, on work release, and actually he's been out of the hospital for many years. But a couple times in the last few years, he's lied about what he's done while being released. There was a time when he was supposed to be at the movies, and he was actually found at a bookstore in front of a display of Reagan books. So
it sounds like he's over it, right?
Well, the doctors have all said that he's over it. He no longer, poses a threat to society. But, listen, if you shoot the president, maybe that puts you in a class of people that should never see the light of day. So I think he shouldn't be released, but
I don't see why they would release him either.
Yeah.
They should shoot him. Why don't they just shoot him? Is that legal? Let's get into legal aspirations. Can you just shoot the guy?
In today's world, you cannot just shoot someone. This isn't the Wild West.
Just figured I would ask.
Just line him up against the White House and put a bullet in him.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. Let's move to the Democratic ticket. You always learn things about nominees. This is Vice Presidential candidate Tim Kaine, who's a senator from Virginia. He actually got his start as a civil rights lawyer, and we have learned that his first high-profile victory, this is Whiteside money, a big one, a $100 million verdict against Nationwide.
Bring it home to Poppy. Oh, that sounds awesome. $100 million? Yeah, it was a great verdict that he had early on. It was the largest civil rights verdict at its time, and was later overturned by the Supreme Court, unfortunately, on a technicality. But they did settle for still big money, $17.5 million, of which Kaine earned a whopping $5.8 million. What a great way to start the legal career. So, Kaine, nice job as a trial attorney. We like to see those big verdicts against insurance companies.
The Slender Man trial, teen girls accused of Slender Man stabbing to stand trial. They're going to stand trial as adults. This is one of the first issues we ever dealt with here on Legal Faceoff back in 2014.
Way back in the early days of Legal Faceoff. The judge, the appellate court this week ruled that they can be tried as adults. These are two girls in Waukesha, Wisconsin, who were 12 at the time of this crime. They stabbed another friend of theirs, also 12. A young girl who is 12 years old. They stabbed her 19 times, left her for dead. She crawled away and survived. And in Wisconsin, actually, the law is that if you're 10 years old and you commit a homicide or attempted homicide, then you're automatically considered an adult for purposes of trial. The trial judge in this case enforced that law. The young girl's attorney argued that they should be tried as juveniles, the big difference being, huge disparity in time. As a juvenile, they would serve maybe 3 years plus supervision. As adults, they're now going to face 45 years in prison. So the court this week upheld the decision that they would be tried as adults, which I think is appropriate. I mean, what 10-year-old doesn't know that stabbing another, you know, kid 19 times is wrong?
Or it's going to lead to their death. I mean, it's pretty obvious.
And the evidence in this case was actually not that it was that it wasn't a spontaneous event.
It was
planned over months.
I know, it was a sad situation to see such young people engage in those acts, too. But at the same time, they're heinous enough to rise to there should be some adult consequences attached to it.
Here's the crazy thing. So yesterday I was on Bill and Wendy talking about this thing.
No, really?
On WGN.
Oh,
I know, just
my goodness.
A shameless plug.
Awesome.
And I tweeted about it. I said I'm going to be talking about the Slenderman thing on Bill and Wendy. So I'm in the cab on the way back to the office. And I don't tweet much, so I don't have many followers, but I get one like, right? I pop up the thing and it says one like.
Was it Brent Ames?
I open the like. Guess who the like is from?
Who?
Bum, bum, bum.
I know it's not me.
Slenderman.
Are you serious?
I kid you not. It was from Slenderman, who liked my tweet talking about Slenderman. And you pull it up, and it's a pic. It's not verified. It's not the verified account, so it's one of many Slenderman accounts. But
there are those robots that just hinge on like keywords. So yeah. I think they were probably just refreshing their Slenderman feed at home. And
hey, I'm not up and up on the social media. Is that called catfishing, sort of? Is that what it is?
It could be.
Watch your back.
If I come over the console and stab you, you'll know that Slenderman told me to do it.
34 members of the Latin King street gang in Chicago were charged with racketeering conspiracy in federal indictments unveiled on Tuesday. Nothing like a good old racketeering story.
It's crazy. They took them down just like the mob from the 80s. They arrested 17 gang members and from Northwest Indiana through Chicago, all through Illinois. And they did it under the RICO and racketeering guidelines, saying that these gang members operated almost like a corporation from the top down, where they engaged in activities like prostitution, gambling. Obviously, death seems to follow the group. It was a huge sweeping arrest for the federal government. So they'll all be arraigned, and then we'll see what charges stick.
Yeah, Zach Farden, who's the local federal prosecutor, came out very strongly with the new superintendent of the Chicago Police Department. So pretty aggressive action here locally.
Yeah, it's a great bust.
Professional wrestlers are suing the company that made them what they are, essentially. More than 50 former professional wrestlers sued World Wrestling Entertainment, saying the company is responsible for repeated head trauma, including concussions, lots of neurological damage. The wrestlers, I was actually a big fan of one of these guys, Superfly Snuka, Road Warrior Animal, and Paul Mr. Wonderful Orndorff are among the plaintiffs. So wrestling, going to see a nice little lawsuit come across their door.
Yeah, they said that when they were affiliated with the WWE, you know, back in the day it was the WWF, that the concussions and head trauma they sustained resulted in long-term brain damage. They accused the organization of concealing the risks of brain disease, and, you know, force them to engage in these scripted moves and choreography that they knew would result in damages.
It kind of sounds like the NFL.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, much like the lawsuits we've seen in the NFL.
Is there anything in there about the rampant steroid use that they were forced to engage in? Is that going to be a separate lawsuit?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, same thing. Like a lot of, you know, NHL athletes have alleged the same thing, that they've been, you know, forced to use those kind of drugs because of the head trauma. But one of the guys you mentioned, Jimmy Superfly Snuka, was actually charged in 1983 with the death of his girlfriend, but he was ruled incompetent to stand trial, and they based that defense partially on the head trauma that he suffered when he was in the ring.
Well, the Chris Benoit roid rage suicide, remember that? The murder-suicide when, you know, his wife died and then he died, and these wrestlers get pounded for years and years and years, yet don't they know that going in? How does that affect the legal case?
Yeah, I mean, listen, like a lot of them say, the ones who are not currently engaged in lawsuits, they say, we knew the risk, we would do it over again. Yeah. But this stuff is, I mean, you'll see more and more of it, obviously, as you know, more news comes out about, you know, traumatic brain injuries and the effects on athletes.
Yeah, and it's just the same in the NFL, as in the NFL too, with the head concussions and trauma too. So it'll be interesting. Maybe the WWE puts together a fund to help out with the retired players. Isn't there a TV show? I mean, I don't watch much reality TV, but isn't there a TV show with a wrestler who helps former wrestlers recover?
Not sure. I haven't
Crickets,
seen it.
Nothing. No one.
Probably. But I haven't seen it.
He's too busy watching anchors on
CNN. And can you think of any other obscure sports show? C-SPAN.
Way to bring the show to a grinding halt with something no one has ever heard of, Jason. Yeah.
Two more topics to go on the legal grab bag. Breaking news as of yesterday, a really surprising twist in the Freddie Gray case, Rich.
Yeah, Freddie Gray, of course, was the motorist in Baltimore who died in April 2015 of a spinal cord injury after being transported in the back of a van. He was not handcuffed. He was not secured. And he died, and then six police officers were charged by the new state's attorney in Baltimore. She came out very strongly right away, basically, in my opinion, you know, calling them guilty, which I thought was totally inappropriate, and, you know, colored the entire case, and actually, in my opinion, led to the fact that she was unsuccessful. But then four of the six were tried. One of them resulted in a mistrial. The other three were acquitted. This week it was decided that they would drop remaining charges against the three additional police officers awaiting trial. The state's attorney, the same one who came out, very forcefully initially, Marilyn Mosby, came out yesterday and said, you know, we don't agree. Freddie Gray didn't kill himself. Again, I think personally her conduct in this whole thing has been pretty unfortunate. She basically in the media said that these people were guilty before even having the benefit of a trial.
I mean, and that's what the criminal justice system is set up for. Put it before a jury, whatever the jury, it's a jury of the peers of both Freddie Gray and the police officers, and whatever the jury decides, they decide. And the jury obviously decided there wasn't enough evidence to convict the officers, or they weren't guilty because obviously they were acquitted and mistrial. So
we'll close things out with a story out of Atlanta, Georgia. A man named Brandon Lee Gary admitted that he took cell phone video of a woman's skirt while she shopped at a grocery store, but a Georgia court is now saying that he actually didn't break the law.
Yeah, I mean, there is no law on the books right now for upskirting, but I guess that's what the kids are calling it. But
is that actually a term,
upskirting? That's what this article says, is upskirting in quotes.
You've never heard of upskirting?
No, I never have.
I've never upskirted before. Wow.
Only Rich has. Yeah. Rich knows exactly what upskirting is.
Keep moving on. Yeah.
So Brandon Lee Gary was stooping behind a woman, aiming a cell phone up her skirt as she was just shopping in the supermarket. Did it three more times. She caught him, reported it. It led to a judge convicting Gary of criminal invasion of privacy. But then there was it went up to the appellate court. And they determined that the space underneath the woman's skirt does not count as a private place.
Oh!
And therefore, it was there is no law to protect that.
I mean, one of the stupidest decisions that you've ever heard, that because this happened in a public place,
it's not private,
it's
then?
It's not private, right. Even though you're, you know, so literally in someone's private.
If he breaks into her house, then it's okay.
Exactly.
And doesn't upskirt. Yeah,
ridiculous.
It's a stupid decision. So, but hopefully that puts something on the books for each state to enact some sort of law to cover that.
You learn something new every day.
Upskirting, Sam.
Upskirting. That is the word of the day. Not a good word to use, and not certainly. It is legal in Georgia, though, so yeah. Be careful.
Jason, your flight to Atlanta is leaving shortly.
I'm going to go check out what Rich talks about with this upskirting thing.
There may be a field trip to go see Team USA beat Venezuela by 50. We'll keep you posted on that.
USA. USA.
For anything you may have missed, WGNplus.com. Search for Legal Face-Off. For Rich and Jason, I am Sam. We will see you in a couple of weeks on WGN.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg Limited for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.